You're listening to Opera Box Score.
Let's get ready to rumble!
Wherever you are, however you're listening, it's America's talk radio show about opera. It's Opera Box Score. I'm Weston Williams, joined by Oliver Camacho, Matt Cummings, and Ashley Hardgrave. All right, this week, the opera world says goodbye to the legendary Sir Andrew Davis. And then, as today is Earth Day, we go inside the huddle with John Mark Rosendahl, a musician and Extinction Rebellion activist who disrupted the Met's Tannhäuser last winter. Plus, in the two-minute drill, all aboard the Kabelje Express, choo-choo! Yeah. Make sure you subscribe to our podcast on Spotify. Click follow on Apple Podcasts. Hit the plus sign. Send us a voice memo or email us your hot takes. mailbag@operaboxscore.com. Or just record your thoughts using the You Got Something to Say tab on our website, operaboxscore.com. However you contribute, you'll get an OBS beer coaster, an OBS lapel pin, and a number one OBS fan foam finger, just for sharing your own hot take. And without further ado, Ashley Hardgrave, what is the hot goss?
I don't know if it's the hot goss, but it's the high five, which is congratulations to Morgan, whose last name I totally just blanked on. I'm going to find that. she is a gymnast from Fisk University. She is the first HBCU gymnast to win a national title. She won the Women's Collegiate National Championships this week. Ooh. She is a force to be reckoned with, and I'm really proud of her. I'm going to find her. Morgan Price. That's it. Sorry, I had to get my Google to catch up with me. Congratulations to Morgan Price of Fisk University for winning the first HBCU snatch national title. Good job.
Matt Cummings, do you have any hot goss you have to frantically Google?
Only that dads aren't here tonight, as you may have noticed. So, you know, the kids are running the show. We're kicking it off with at least something Olympics watch adjacent. Everyone's happy.
Don't tell mom, the babysitter's dead.
It's going to be such a fun show. We're going to have an obituary, talk about sexual abuse, and also potential extinction of humanity. It's going to be fun. Strap in, folks. Let's talk some opera.
Chalk Talk on Opera Box Score.
The opera community lost a giant this week. Sir Andrew Davis, who headed orchestras on three continents, has passed away at age 80. There will be many glowing global tributes and retrospectives, but for us here at the Chicago-based OBS, he is also a hometown hero. Tonight, we take a look back at his connections to the city, and we celebrate his magical musical life. Matt, Weston, what are your first, like, when I say Sir Andrew Davis, what are the first, like, words and phrases that pop up to you?
Joy is a big one. Anytime he came on stage at Lyric Opera, the man just radiated joy in music making, yeah. Joy in collegiality, joy in just, like, being there.
It's really true. I remember the first ever any kind of music I heard in Chicago was at the Lyric Opera. And I don't remember exactly what show it was. It might have been Rheingold. But I remember I came in and I was way up in the cheapest seats you could possibly find. And, you know, I leaned over for that initial applause and you can just see his smile beaming all the way in the back row. And, you know, that is, you know, in itself that he was able to project that out, I think, is something that a lot of people remember him for. I mean, almost even more than the music, like the presence he had at the Lyric, and, you know, I'm sure every institution that had their hooks in him, you know, I really felt that presence. And I will say, once, you know, news broke that he passed a few days ago, I have seen so many tributes from so many people, not just in the Chicagoland area, but beyond that, you know, coming out of the woodwork to say how much he touched their lives. And I think that is certainly, that's the impression that I think I'll always have of him, is that goodwill just radiating out from him from the moment you first set your eyes and ears on him.
I think it's especially true just because of, like, how personal all the tributes feel, you know sometimes. when they really start pouring out, it becomes a competition to see like who can come up with a better story about the person who just died and how it relates to them and how really it means that, like, they, the person posting this, are the coolest person in the world. But that is not the tone that I'm getting from any of these tributes to Sir Andrew. Like, they are just... they're really awestruck about how amazing of a musician and of a human being he was, and just what a tremendous loss this is for Chicago, but the musical world and the world in general.
Yeah, this is definitely, you know, we think of him as someone that is here. And if you've been anywhere in the musical landscape of the city of Chicago for the last 20 some odd years, you know, you think of him as like this local guy. But he, you know, he was one of the longest serving conductors of the BBC Symphony Orchestra. He has, of course, this tenure here. He had notable positions in Toronto. So he was just this person who was kind of all over. So why don't we talk a little bit, just a quick little bit of biographical information about him, just to sort of set our scenes. Let's see. Matt, would you like to take some of that?
Sir Andrew Davis was born in Hertfordshire during the Second World War, and he showed early signs of musical talent and went on to attend both the Royal College of Music and King's College Cambridge, the latter on an organ scholarship, where he studied under none other than Sir David Wilcox. He then went on to Rome, where he studied conducting at the Accademia di Santa Cecilia, and really made a name for himself as as someone who could jump in to conducting orchestra on a moment's notice. His, you know, kind of his big, like, step up into fame was stepping in at the last minute for the BBC Symphony in a performance of Janáček's Glagolitic Mass, which is an extremely complicated, like, it's an extremely complicated score. The fact that you're able to conduct it at all is a miracle, and the fact that he could conduct it, like, on a day's notice was very, very notable. From there, he went on to he became the conductor laureate and chief conductor of the Toronto Symphony Orchestra in 1975, and had a long relationship with them going all the way until 1988. In 1989, he became the music director at Glyndebourne Festival Opera and the conductor laureate and chief conductor of the BBC Symphony Orchestra.
And Glyndebourne's where he met Jana, I believe.
Yes, that is correct. And there is only one other conductor who bests him in terms of his tenure at the BBC Symphony Orchestra, and that is its founder, Sir Adrian Bolt. So not a bad, you know, track record there. Both of those positions ended in 2000 when he took on the music director and chief conductor position at Lyric Opera that he held for just over 20 years. He had first appeared with that company back in the 80s and conducted there sporadically, but then he really made Chicago his home for this entire century, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
If you're like a real calendar watcher and paying attention to those dates, you might have noticed that he was in charge of the BBC Symphony Orchestra in 1997, which meant that he conducted the Last Night of the Proms concert that happened 2 weeks after Princess Diana's death, as well as Mother Teresa's death.
Wow. I hadn't thought about that.
Since they both died, like, within a week of each other. And just to be able to offer music to the public of the United Kingdom in their time of mourning, I know was a powerful thing for him as a musician. There are some other stories that come out about him as a conductor of the BBC proms. Most notably, people like to share the story about how when it came time to give the speech that the conductor usually gives at those concerts, he instead sang his with new lyrics that he had written to the tune of "I Am the Very Model of a Modern Major General."
Yes, I remember that.
Which went something like, "This is the very model of a modern music festival with entertainment sonic promenadable and estival, a word that you have probably never heard before, but means summary. So it's not just a good rhyme, it's also a good lyric. Take that, Tim Rice."
I feel like when a lot of people talk about Sir Andrew Davis, and they're talking about his early career, they think of him as being a very sort of quintessentially English composer, not a conductor, rather.
Yes, quite an affinity for Elgar.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which is, and you know, a lot of like sort of modern recordings of like some Burt Whistle and stuff like that, you know, very, very British stuff. But
Michael Tippett, I think that, who he was a huge supporter of Tippett's compositions.
Absolutely. But he really started, you know, making forays across the pond as well. Maybe not quite as continent hoppy as a lot of modern conductors, but he became kind of well known over here almost as much, if not more so.
Yeah, I would agree. And before we jump into sort of the Chicago years of Sir Davis, I feel like we need to get a little bit of music, a little bit of tunage in here. Oliver gave us some suggestions for some great clips, being the wonderful creative consultant that he is. Matt, what is the first clip we're going to hear?
The first clip that we're going to hear is an excerpt from recording that he made at his most recent appointment, which was at the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra in Australia. And this is the recording that he made with them and with soprano Aaron Wall of the four last songs. This is a little excerpt of Beim Schlafen gehen. In the new millennium, the now old, now quarter over almost, don't think about it too much, new millennium,
oh God.
Sir Andrew Tate brings his persona and his love of music, and above all, his versatility to the podium of lyric opera. And I have to imagine that he was welcome with open arms, because like every single person who talks about him, writes about him, comments about him, make sure to mention that he isn't there. He is no imperious maestro. One article about him writes that he has the cascading laugh and unaffected vocabulary of a jolly school teacher. That kind of happiness and joviality like comes up a lot when his colleagues are talking about him, both at the time and after the fact, which is how you know that it's true. So even though he had obviously, like real orchestral chops, he first conducted an opera, I believe, in 1973 at Glyndebourne, and it was Strauss's Capriccio. And what really stood out to me when I was looking at this part of his career, him, the opera conductor at Lyric, is just how humongous of a repertoire he managed to conduct at that time. Throughout those 20 years, 21, or no, I guess this is through his whole career, not just the 20 years that he was music director, but at Lyric, he conducted 700 performances of 62 operas. Jeez. By 22 different composers. And I want to read that list of composers off for you, because it is really something to behold. So those 22 composers are Alban Berg, Georges Bizet, Hector Berlioz, Benjamin Britten, Antonin Dvorak, Gilbert and Sullivan, Charles Gounod, Engelbert Humperdinck, Leos Janacek, Franz Lehár, Jimmy Lopez Bellido, Jules Massenet, thank you, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, Modest Mussorgsky, Francis Poulenc, Giacomo Puccini, Gioachino Rossini, Richard Strauss, Piotr Ilyich Tchaikovsky, Giuseppe Verdi, Richard Wagner, and Stislav Weinberg. I did not write those first names down. Thank you, Ashley, for the assist.
You, Matt. I can't believe you got all those. Listeners, we just had last names. Matt just filled them in. That's how smart he is.
And I would say, like, of the ones that he could be said to have specialized in, that range would be, like, Baer, Janáček, Mozart, Rossini, Strauss, and Wagner. So even his specialties have range. It's not like he was only interested in the classics. Like, he was, like, Weston, you mentioned earlier, like, he was a real advocate for new repertoire. He had the musical chops to, like, make it happen. At the BBC proms, he would bring in new opera. Lyric did a lot of new opera during his time. It's not necessarily thought of as like a vanguard of the new opera house, but quite so much anymore. But I think that that's a little bit of an elision of like an important part of its history. Some of those recordings that he made are like very notable. Like you mentioned, the Harrison Birtwistle Mask of Orpheus opera recording won the Grammy for Record of the Year in 1987. And on top of this, he became a huge champion of the singers that came through Lyric Opera, and particularly through the Ryan Center. Like, just a few names that come to mind of, like, people who have had huge careers, like, because of their talent, but also, like, with Sir Andrew's support, were Aaron Wall, like you already heard, Nicole Cabell, Elizabeth Deshong, Matthew Polanzani, and really anyone who came through the Ryan Center.
Yeah. Quinn Kelsey, Wayne Tigges, Joe Kaiser. Yeah, all of those singers that you think of that are just now kind of at the peak of their fame, like the Nicole Cabells, you know, he was working with her and encouraging her, you know, before BBC Singer of the World. This is when she was just a young upstart coming through before it was called the Ryan Center, it was called LOCA, the Lyric Opera Center of American Artists. It's just so interesting to see all of these names kind of together, you know, with Aaron Wall and Deshong, because all of those folks were just like, you know, cutting their teeth when they first got to Chicago and started working with Sir Andrew.
Let's hear another clip from, let's go with Nicole Cabell. This is an excerpt of the aria disc that she recorded with Andrew Davis conducting the London Symphony Orchestra. This would have been shortly after she won the Cardiff Singer of the World, and this is an excerpt of her singing Juliet's Poison aria. So many singers in the old days would just like leave that aria out because they couldn't handle it. And she makes it sound easy. Like, and a lot of that, especially in that French repertoire, which can become so goopy, for lack of a better word, and unwieldy when it's like not conducted well. Like that orchestra is tight. It is taut. And it really raises the tension of that scene, which could so easily feel over the top without that.
There's a clip that I found that is not singing, but, you know, we just saw Sir Andrew step down from his position, like, officially in 2021. So it's, you know, pretty recent. And so there were all of these different tributes and things going around. And the Lyric, of course, did a series of sort of retrospectives and celebrations when he was leaving. And there's a really cute clip of him sitting on the Lyric stage doing an interview with Peter Sagal, the host of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And he has a brief conversation with him about sort of how he got into opera in the first place. And again, I think that clip, maybe we'll just add it as like a bonus somewhere on the website. But it's, again, it's just a little insight into, oh, well, you know, I was presented with this and it seemed like a nice idea, so I decided to try it. And then I fell in love with it. And then this is my life. Like, it was just very, you know, it wasn't, I loved opera and this was, you know, he was so delightfully unserious about it, but also like brought, again, the word we keep returning to is joyful. Even that little interview between him and Peter Sagal is just like joyful.
And what I think really comes through with anytime he's doing media, anytime he's talking about these organizations where he's working and where he has these leadership positions, is just this tremendous sense of loyalty and pride and belief in the organization, and just desire to continually up the scales and make it better. And even in an organization where he would come to it and it was already like pretty good, just that unwillingness to take that for what, and always wanting to be carrying the baton further. Like, you can't fake that.
No,
people think that they can fake that, but like, it just comes through so genuinely with him. And I think this quote from an interview that he gave to ABC Australia really sums it up, is like, I've held very few posts, but just held them for a long time. The sense of continuity is very important to me. That, like, very understated British gentlemanly way of saying, I'm here because I care about these places and I want to make art with them and I want to make better and better and better art with them.
You know, I keep coming back to the phrase, brilliant musician, better human. It's no surprise that I am always a big fan of great artists, but I'm an even bigger fan of them when it turns out that they're a nice person that genuinely cares about their fellow musician and fellow neighbor. And Andrew Davis was kind of the personification of that. And we were so blessed here in Chicago to have him at the helm of Lyric for so long, and to have somebody who, you know, as you say, Matt, was so genuinely invested in the city and the musical community of Chicago. You know, this is where he really had roots and built, you know, a good chunk of his personal and professional life, because of course he was here with, you know, his final wife, Jonna Rolandi. She was heading up the Ryan Center for a bit of time. This is where they raised their child, the wonderful Ed Fraser Davis, who is now a very accomplished musician and composer and conductor in his own right. So we were as a city, I think, really lucky that he chose us and he chose this to be one of his musical homes. And I don't think there's going to be another one like him.
I don't think I could have said it any better than that, Ashley. And to take us all home, I would like, we're going to share with you a clip from the Lyric Opera's production of Don Giovanni with Sir Andrew at the helm. This is the end, Questo il fin, because I don't think he would have wanted to be sent off with a dirge. We'll send him off in joy.
Thank you. Huddle up. Let's go inside the huddle.
Last November, John Mark Rosendahl planned, organized, and participated in Extinction Rebellion's protest for climate justice at the Metropolitan Opera, a demonstration that interrupted opening night of Wagner's Tannhäuser for 22 minutes. For our Earth Day episode, we put in our least sympathetic host, Oliver Camacho, to go inside the huddle with this Baroque cellist, viola da gamba player, teacher, and now climate activist, to hear Rosendahl's justification for disrupting an art form that we're all trying to get people to go to. Here is that conversation.
Well, let's just go dive right into it. Why don't you tell us the mission statement of Extinction Rebellion?
Extinction Rebellion has four demands. And our first demand is tell the truth. We demand that government should tell the truth about the climate crisis. We want everybody to tell the truth about the climate crisis. Our second demand is to act now about the climate crisis. Act now, especially to reduce carbon emissions, but to act now in every way to respond to and the sixth mass extinction. The third demand is to act beyond politics. We can't do this by through the elections that we have and through the political arrangements that we now have. So the third demand is for citizens' assemblies to guide government in this crisis. And the fourth demand is for a just transition. So what we're demanding is not a green economy that has all the same kind of injustice and exploitation that our current economy has. We're looking for a transition to the post-fossil fuel economies that includes justice for the global south and for the most exploited peoples in the world, the people who are already suffering from the climate crisis.
Well, I want to talk about what that might look like and what a way forward could be for us as a civilization. And I know that there are many steps that we would need to take. But before we get to that, can you talk about some of your notable campaigns to date?
So right now, Extinction Rebellion has two, I should say, Extinction Rebellion New York City has two campaigns going on. We have a campaign going on at the American Museum of Natural History, where we are appealing to the museum to direct museum visitors to a climate crisis exhibit that's worthy of the museum. Right now, they have a very small and poor climate crisis exhibit, which is in a sort of remote corner of the museum, and it's, you can't find it on a map. It's not marked on the maps of the museum. The staff doesn't know where it is. If you ask people at staff members at the American Museum of Natural History, where is the climate crisis exhibit or the climate change exhibit? They don't know. They can't tell you. So we're demanding that the American Museum of Natural History do much, much better with its mission of educating the public. And our second campaign is a series of actions that we're calling small numbers, big impact, because we're noticing that actions performed by small numbers of people really, really can make a big, big impact. Last summer, my friend Shayok interrupted the women's semifinal match in the
U.S. Open,
in the U.S. Open tennis tournament. Thank you very much. And it got enormous amounts of press, and it took actually, you know, three activists and a small backup team to make that happen. So since then, we've interrupted a Broadway play. We interrupted the Easter service at St. Patrick's. We've interrupted the Metropolitan Opera, a fundraising event at the American Museum of Natural History. So small numbers, big impact to bring attention to this climate crisis.
You were in the news very recently for interrupting an enemy of the people on Broadway. That got a lot of attention, and I'd like to hear about planning that particular action and knowing, because I know a little bit about you outside of your activism, but knowing exactly what was the right moment and maybe what is the right event that will get that type of attention?
Yeah. So actually, we were looking at Broadway as a place to do an action. And we were looking down the schedule and I said, An Enemy of the People, that has to be the play that we have to do, because that's about telling the truth. And it's about an ecological crisis. This great, great play by Henry Ibsen. And I thought, well, Nate Smith has to be the person to lead that. And because he's a wonderful actor and activist. So, you know, we put together a team to imagine the whole thing. And Nate, along with fellow activists, our comrades, Kyle and Lydia, they performed it beautifully. Nate knew exactly what to do. There's a fantastic scene in the middle of An Enemy of the People, which is a town meeting, in which the Dr. Stockman is prepared to speak to the people of this town about the crisis in the poisoned water, the polluted water at the town's baths, which are the source of the town's wealth and well-being. And the townspeople, they democratically vote to silence Dr. Stockman, to say that he can't speak about this in this town hall meeting. So Nate and Kyle and Lydia interrupted that town meeting to say, we object to the silencing of Dr. Stockman. We need to talk about the climate crisis.
And so the audience didn't understand what was happening because it felt organic.
It played so well. It played so beautifully. And actually, this kind of like meta theater, theater about theater, is such a common thing now. Not only did the audience think that the producers of the play had set this up, critics thought that the producers of the play had set this up. I think some of the actors actually thought that their producer had set them up on this. So it really played beautifully, and it had wonderful, wonderful press. our intervention in that play got great reviews. I think the Washington Post reviewer really liked our intervention better than he liked the production.
Well, it shows a certain amount of intelligence and thoughtfulness about the protest. Obviously, it was very well timed, and it did what it was supposed to do. I think you were lucky in having, you know, sympathetic, you know, actors on the stage. And I also will say that Coco Gauff, during the U.S. Open protest, was sympathetic. And, you know, when interviewed backstage, she said, I agree. You know, it's like, I'm on their team, you know, and she handled it so well. And she went on to win the U.S. Open. So it was a win-win for everybody. I have to say, you're a musician. I'm a musician. The protest at the Metropolitan Opera really bothered me. I feel like, you know, there is this thing about safety in the theater that is a real topic right now because of gun violence and because of protests happening over the war in Ukraine, because of protests happening over the conflict in the Middle East. We don't really know what is the impetus for a protest, if it's just one man going off the rails, or if it's, as what you guys are trying to do, really make a statement and use art that is, you know, has people deeply immersed and has people really focused on artistry to hear your message. And I could just imagine, not that I would ever take my dad to Tannhäuser, because that's not my opera, but taking my 82-year-old dad to the opera, who has mobility issues, who uses a walker and is very slow to get in and out of an aisle at a theater. I could imagine me and my dad at the opera and there being this emergency happening and trying to get him out of the theater, or maybe just get him on the ground because I think maybe there's an active shooting happening. How do you respond to that?
Well, we didn't do anything to make anybody unsafe. You know, feeling unsafe is a very subjective thing. I was shouting. There's a climate crisis going on. As I say, we didn't do anything to make anybody feel unsafe. If people feel unsafe because I'm shouting, the water is polluted, I don't know what to do about that subjective feeling that people might have. And as I say, we did nothing to make anybody feel unsafe. Other members of the audience actually did act in ways that were extremely unsafe for one of our protesters. One of our protesters was assaulted by audience members in the theater. She had to be escorted out under the care of ushers to be protected from audience members who were assaulting her.
I mean, I don't know who that protest was for. I understand the message, and I agree with the message. Is why Tannhäuser, why the Met, why? I mean, is there something about opera being for an elite audience that makes it a good target?
Well, one of the features of our campaign is that we interrupt what we love. So when Shayok went to the U.S. Open tennis tournament, he's a tennis player. He loves tennis, and the message is here that these things that we love, they will be interrupted by climate crisis. So we want to call attention to this climate crisis. We want to bring attention to the climate crisis to the communities where we actually have a stake. So I care about the opera. I want people in the opera house to understand the climate crisis, to understand the urgency of it. You know, if nobody behaves as if there's a crisis, then it's hard to believe that there is a crisis. So we're trying to communicate that urgency through urgent actions. We have artists taking action inside art museums. Nate Smith, who led the action at the Enemy of the People, he is an actor. He loves the theater. So we are disrupting what we love, because the climate crisis will disrupt what we love. So the slogan that we're taking to all these places is there's no tennis on a dead planet. There's no art on a dead planet. There's no opera on a dead planet. There's no theater on a dead planet.
I already said that, you know, Wagner is not my thing. That I would rather see something else. But I'm a singer, and I understand the level of preparation, not just, you know, that day preparation for performance, but the lifetime of preparation it takes to sing a Wagner opera. I understand the lifetime of preparation it takes to sing, you know, a Bach cantata for an audience of 100 people, you know. It is so much work and requires so much focus and so much skill, and that you are perfectly healthy at the moment. How do you address the artists who are trying to be the best versions of themselves and trying to demonstrate their skill and preparation for a piece that many people think is like a sacred work of art?
I mean, the idea that Tannhäuser is a sacred work of art,
It's not to me, but you know, you get what I'm saying.
And it's hilarious that anybody in this day and age would think that libretto is such a horror to me anyway. But the score is packed with gorgeous, gorgeous music. The videographer who was sitting with me is a person who had never been to the opera house before. And when the orchestra started playing the overture, she just burst into tears. She'd never heard anything like it. And the precise singer who I interrupted was Christian Gerhaer, who was having his Metropolitan Opera debut that night. And I have to say, it hurt me to shout over his aria, because he's one of the most beautiful singers living. But all of our disruptive actions, we always weigh the disruptive nature of what we're doing against the importance of what the climate crisis is. And we're looking at a crisis that's not being addressed, that stands to displace in the coming decades billions of the world's people. It over the next 30 years, some scientists are estimating we could see 7 billion people die. And the world is not responding to this. So that's the stakes we're looking at. We're looking at people who have spent years and years preparing to perform against literally billions of people dying. That's how we decide whether these things are worthy or not.
Do you have a thought about who are the real audiences for these protests? And I ask that with, I'm trying to be charitable here. Like, are you talking to, you know, New York elites who go to the opera or who go to Flushing Meadows or who go to Broadway plays who generally are sympathetic to the message?
This may sound glib, but our audience is everybody who can hear us. So, you know, we don't really expect that our actions are going to make the CEO of an oil company become a climate activist. That's not what will happen. But we're hoping that many, many of the people who hear us will move a little bit in the direction of activism. No one of these actions is going to save the world. But we're hoping that by doing one after another, we're going to move some people to be ready to take action in the climate crisis. So it was a complicated audience we knew that would be at the Metropolitan Opera. We knew that in that room, there would be people with power and money who would hear us. And we knew that there would be very, very relatively ordinary people in that room. We want both of those constituents to hear us. And we knew that it would get press coverage. We chose the opening night for that production so that because we knew that the press would be there, and they were. We were right. In the New York Times, we got both a news story and a lot of coverage in the review. So we look for places to take our message where we expect that it will be amplified and get a large audience.
Without betraying your plans, are there other types of spectacles or events that are ripe for protest if you had the capacity and the stealthness?
Yes.
All right. Finally, John Mark, how would you like people to get involved, especially for people who care about, who want to be active and who want to make a difference? And understand that, you know, bringing their plastic bag back to the grocery store is not quite enough. What can we do that would not put other people in danger and feel unsafe? I know you want this to be an emergency, but some of us like to work a little bit more compassionately to our environment.
So, I am in encouraging people to get involved in activism, beyond recycling and beyond voting and beyond politics. So I do encourage people to consider nonviolent direct action. But another way of being an activist that I'm encouraging people to do is to think that another world is possible, and to think about how we can live very, very differently from how we're living. As I say, the green economy is where we make everything electric and go on consuming just exactly what we're consuming right now. That's not the way out of the climate crisis. A real solution to the climate crisis certainly involves degrowth and living with a different kind of consumption of what we have now. So think about how you can have a satisfying and rich life that consumes differently, especially eating differently from how this society is eating. We really, in order to accommodate the people who are on this planet now. And we can. This planet can feed 8 billion people, but not if everybody needs to eat meat every day.
Does the classical music industry, as it exists now, does it make it through the purity test of the new green world?
There's no purity test here, but actually we travel a lot on airplanes,
mm-hmm.
way more than I think that we need to do in order to have satisfying and rich musical lives in every city. So that's a place we can look at and explore. I'm not asking anybody to make a rule that says nobody gets to fly anywhere, but I would appeal to organizers of events to look really, really closely at the talent in their own communities before they fly someone in from another continent.
Well, I guess Cecilia Bartoli had it right all along. She doesn't like flying. She'll take a boat. Okay, John Mark, I know that there's more we could talk about and more we could learn, but I just wanted our audience to understand your intentions and to hear the name Extinction Rebellion and to be aware that that next great event that you think you are so excited to go attend is not as exciting as staying alive, being one of the not 7 billion people who make it into the future. Any parting words, Jean-Marc?
Thank you for saying the name Extinction Rebellion of our organization. Our organization is aptly named because we are looking at extinction. That's our issue that we're looking at, the sixth mass extinction. You know, in the last 50 years, this planet has lost 70% of its wildlife population. And extinctions of species are going on now at 100 times the background rate. This is what science tells us. Government is not responding to this. So this is a rebellion in the strictest sense.
This just in, the 2-minute drill.
All right, listen up. Here's everything you need to know about what happened in Operaland this week.
The online fallout from the sexual abuse scandal at the New York Phil continues. And unsurprisingly, we've got opinions. More after the drill.
The Spanish Commission of Transport has approved a proposal to rename Barcelona's Sants train station after Montserrat Caballé. The proposal says that Caballé, quote, was one of the best sopranos in history and someone who has spread Barcelona's name to the world with talent and strength.
Crunching the numbers, Welsh National Opera is cutting back its 24-25 season to make up for budget shortfalls stemming from the Great Arts Council England and Arts Council Wales defunding. All told, the company will be losing £6.7 million from these art councils, forcing the cancellation of a tour to the Bristol Hippodrome and the venue Cymru in North Wales. A planned spring performance of Rigoletto will also be postponed until autumn.
Score another win for the Curtis Institute of Music as the school expands its conducting program, and it's announced Yannick Nezet-Sagan as its selection for inaugural head of conducting. The new initiative aims to train conductors for operatic as well as symphonic pursuits.
On the disabled list, soprano Wendy Bryn Harmer contracted a viral infection that is forcing her to pull out of Atlanta Opera's upcoming production of Die Walküre. Friend of the show, Christine Gerke, will take over in the title role.
Exit stage right, German conductor Michael Boder has died at the age of 65. He was known for his interpretations of modern German operas by the likes of Reimann, Berg, Hindemith, and Henze, all my favorites. Boder also served as music director of the Basel Opera between 1988 and 1993.
And on this day, April 22nd, we have a number of first performances. 1749, Jean-Philippe Rameau's opera ballet Naïs, premiered in Paris. In 1845, Daniel Auber's La Barcarolle ou L'amour et la musique premiered also in Paris. One more for Paris, big day for Paris, Jacques Offenbach's Les Anatons premiered on this day in 1875. 1924, Victor Herbert's operetta The Dream Girl premiered outside of Paris in the Paris of Connecticut, New Haven. And Manfred Gerlitz Wolzeck, not the one you know, the other one, and not the other one that you know by Tom Waits, the third one, premiered in Bremen, that was in 1926, and over the radio from NBC in New York in 1939, it was Giancarlo Menotti's opera The Old Maid and the Thief.
1858 brought us the birth of English composer and suffragette Dame Ethel Smith in Kent. On this day in 1899, English baritone and Gilbert and Sullivan patter specialist Martin Green was born. 1912 brought us the birth of English contralto Kathleen Ferrier. On this day in 1935 was the birth of Italian contralto Fiorenza Cossotto near Turin. She created Sister Matilda in Dialogue of the Carmelites. 1935, today was the birthday of American bass Richard Best here in Chicago. Happy birthday on this day in 1941 to the Russian mezzo-soprano Galina Borisova. 1956 brought us the birth of Finnish conductor Jukka-Pekka Saraste, and hello and happy birthday in 1960 to Australian soprano Cheryl Barker in Sydney.
And that is your 2-minute drill.
Heard mezzo-soprano Fiorenza Cossotto trying valiantly as she could to steal the spotlight from Leontine Price in Lee's farewell performance of Aida at the Met in 1985. It was conducted by someone we don't talk about, but it was at the Met, so you can put two and two together.
Speaking of valiantly trying to steal the spotlight from from something else, I mean, I really do like Manfred Gerlitz's Wolzeck. It's pretty good, but, you know, the Berg is better.
I'm sure Sir Andrew would agree.
Well, you know who didn't agree is our own hosting team after George and I tried to unpack an ideal music curriculum of the future. Sounds like Uncle Oliver had a little bone to pick with us and had some disagrees about our comments here. Oliver gripes about our conversation, strong in all caps, disagree about opera scenes workshops. For someone like me, during my undergrad experience at Northwestern, which had so many grad students competing with undergrads, I would have had no experience on stage until senior year if it weren't for the scenes. You know what, Oliver, I take that point. How else can a director and coach teach canonical repertoire to large groups of their constituents? There isn't enough time in a 4-year program to address every major composer and style in the main stage operas, let alone if they are forsaking canon in favor of 5 to 15 minute one acts. He put that in air quotes. I think that was supposed to be an insult. Can you name, all caps, any examples of these so-called 5-minute roles that would benefit a young singer who barely knows how to sing legato or what that means? Point, Camacho. Following point, George, who also complains. Let's look at the actual stats. Wise Classical Music, one of the world's biggest conglomerate of publishers, lists 19 operas under 5 minutes, 17 operas 5 to 10 minutes, and 46 operas 10 to 20 minutes. So yes, there are options for my idea. Failing that, if we do end up doing scenes, let's at least pull them from all the same show so that students can prepare a single role and talk about the show in question all together. Gentlemen, thoughts on anything that's been presented to you so far?
I mean, you know, like, I kind of like the little compromise at the end there from George. But once again, you know, Oliver and George always giving their spicy takes and actually dipping for the show. That's the theme of this episode for sure. I think it is a good point. And it is something to bear in mind if you are one of those people out there wondering which school is the best for you. You know, maybe ask about the scenes and the workshops and the performance opportunities, because that will be an important thing to consider as you go forward out into the musical education world.
I've always been a bit of a minority in that I actually really like opera scenes programs. I think that they are fun. I think sometimes it's nice to be able to get exposure to a role where you wouldn't be able to sing the whole thing, but some little piece of it is very good for you right in that minute. Like, it does all kind of come down to how well they're curated, which I don't think that Oliver Camacho, of all people, would be arguing in favor of poorly curated programs. But not all opera scenes programs are created equal, in that some are very good and both for the singers and the audience, and some are good for neither.
This is definitely only the beginning of the conversation. Listeners, we want to know if you're talking to me, the dean of the OBS School of Music, and we're creating the ultimate curriculum for the modern singer, do you believe George? Do you believe Oliver? Do you believe somewhere in between? Please let us know using the You Got Something to Say section of our site. But in the meantime, I will continue to keep holding curricular meetings and trying to figure out which part of those 136 credits I need to remove for business classes.
It sounds like you might have something to say, Ashley.
I always have something to say. Why do you think I come here every week?
Well, speaking of needing Ashley to say something, we have the one big story, which is not actually the Caballé train station, although I do love that story. We've had an obituary. We've had a controversial climate change, a rebellion. And now we're getting into the continued fallout over this New York Philharmonic story that, you know, happened a while ago, and then the perpetrators were reinstated, and now they have been suspended once again. And let me tell you what, the general vibe on the internet is really, really kicking off as of right now, as of this day recording, Monday, April 22nd. I am seeing some really intense takes, and I think they were probably kicked off due to the editorial by Anne Majette. We will have the link for that on our website, of course, where she really starts calling people out and taking names.
Yeah, I honestly, like, I will cop to being a bit of a Stan Majette in that, like, I just don't think that the woman misses very much. Like, she has very strong opinions, but they are well informed, and like, when it comes to like journalistic reporting, very, very well researched. So I think that I can go out a limb on saying that, like, Anne Majette has receipts if she's willing to do this kind of calling out. And her open letter was really taking these arts organizations that are posting really kind of milquetoast posts of support, given what she knows about what goes on behind the scenes, in that they all, any arts organization, be it an educational, be it an orchestra, be it an opera company, when there are allegations of sexual assault or misconduct like this, they kind of exist in like a Schrödinger's cat situation of, if the journalist can quote unquote get the story, and that being the only determinant of like whether or not it becomes public. And so she's really calling out all these people who sit back and like on the sidelines waiting to see if the journalists can happen to uncover the secret information that everyone knows, but won't talk about until after the journalist gets the story.
Yeah, she has this example in the article of an organization calling her when there were rumors that there was going to be a story dropped about Plácido Domingo before his actions became known to the general public.
Became more known to the general public. More known,
because that one was an open secret before, like, for years. Years.
Exactly. But this organization was going to give Plácido Domingo an award. And basically, they were calling because there was a rumor going around that he was finally going to be exposed. But the framing was not, should we give this man an award because if he's done these horrible things? The framing was, is the timing going to be good? Like, are we going to look bad if we
give
this award?
Yeah, are we going to get egg on our face if we're in the news right now?
It's such a toxic mindset, and one that is still, unfortunately, quite pervasive in a lot of classical music organizations. And certainly, you know, even though I think there has been some progress in that regard, this New York Philharmonic story, you know, I think is a reminder that we ain't there yet, you know? We just ain't.
We absolutely aren't, you know, and Anne Majette is one of the great voices to sort of follow as you're sort of unpacking and learning what you wish to learn about this set of circumstances. Another voice I would encourage you to look at is a call that's coming from even further inside the house of Catherine Needleman. Catherine Needleman is an oboist. She's had jobs at a bunch of major places and has been a part of this community for a long time. And she has been unafraid to call these people out, to say what she knows. And now people, because she has been so vocal, are sending her DMs, which she is also beginning to publish on her Facebook page. And they are, let's put it this way, you know, she's redacting the actual thing so that there's no, like, you know, slander or anything like that. But, you know, when you say, I'm sure you assumed many things about myself and redacted disgrace BFM, that's big fancy man of oboe. There's only a handful of those over the last few years. You know, redacted major Midwest orchestra, redacted major Midwest Big Five orchestra. Guess which Big Five orchestra is in the Midwest? There's only one. And I don't have to tell you who that is. And if you want to know, DM me and I'll tell you, because I don't want to get sued. But it's another one of those voices. So the stories that are coming out that aren't part of some, you know, whether you want to call it a hit piece or not, these pieces that are coming from major publications, you just got to go to socials. You don't even have to wait for the journalism to happen. So there's lots going on, and there's going to be lots to come from this. And some of the things that have come from it most recently, Gary Gensling, this poor guy, he's the CEO of the New York Phil. He's only been in the job for, I don't know, a little over or under a year. And so he has published a statement. While the two gentlemen, Matthew Mielke and Liang Wang, have been listed on the New York Philharmonic's roster, those are the two gentlemen who have kind of been at the center of the piece that was in Vulture for New York Mag. Mm-hmm. They're mm-hmm. the ones that are part of the conversation around the horn player Kerr Kaiser in 2010. So Gary Gensling put out a statement last week on behalf of the Phil that was, you know, very much like the details are in the New York Magazine article are horrifying to me, and I'm not far into my tenure as president and CEO, but this is a very concerning thing. So here are some immediate steps that I'm going to take. I have seen executives make these sort of statements and say they're taking these sort of measures before. Time will tell. But basically, the Phil has hired a managing partner of Jenner & Block, which is one of the biggest and most prestigious law firms in the U.S., to do an independent, extensive investigation. And this person that they've hired, Katja Justin, she's got a lot of experience in sexual misconduct interviews. He's basically giving her carte blanche. You can leave no stone unturned, whatever metaphor you want to use there, or whatever turn of phrase that would be. So he's giving, you know, Jenner and Block the ability to fully investigate everything that's happening. I am worried about what they will find. But anyway, he also says his second point is, for the time being, the musicians Matthew Mielke and Liang Wang are not being assigned to any Philharmonic activity as we work through this process. A decision about their future with the New York Phil will be made in due course. Cool. Okay. We'll see how that goes. And then finally, the other thing that is really sort of a knife in the side when it comes to the story with Kerr Kaiser was the denial of tenure. And so right. the positions, when people were winning positions in these orchestras, the major, you know, the principals were unblind auditions, or you knew who was behind the curtain. And then the core positions, like the ones that Kerr Kaiser got, that was a blind audition. But then to gain tenure after winning that blind audition, basically you had to kind of play nice with the rest of the orchestra because they were the ones that were going to be voting on your tenure. And as such, the third point that this CEO has made has said that they're going to be doing extensive audition and tenure review, policy review. They're going to be working for, you know, transparency and oversight and equity. They're going to be working with the local 802. Again, it sounds nice. And he closes with, nothing is more important than the culture of our orchestra and the safety of our musicians and staff. It's only through this process that we will build the kind of vibrant and inclusive culture we all want. No duh, Gary Gensling, where you been?
And I think what's really interesting about that, about the union call out, is that really the devil is going to be in the details. And of course, as the CEO and president of a major organization like this, like, you can't you can't put the cart before the horse. Sorry to make so many metaphors in here. when you're talking about labor agreements, because those are very ironclad usually, and not something that it's easy to like untangle or to circumvent even, like, which is usually ostensibly a good thing, yeah, that you can't just like go around these labor protections. But the fact that what was like so galling to me when I was getting caught up on this whole NY Phil story, because I wasn't on the show last week, is the fact that the Mucky and Wong were able to use the union grievance process to circumvent
their jobs back,
to get their jobs back and to avoid having to take responsibility for crimes that are really, really seems like they committed.
Crimes, you know, this is not just a disagreement with a coworker. Like, if these things happened, and we're going to put a big old allegedly on that, like, these are crimes, you know. And again, if you didn't check out all the details since our last show, you can find the initial Vulture article that came out a couple weeks ago now. I'm sure we can put that on the website again, make sure it's there where people can see it. It is rough. These are next
horrifying
level
allegations. Yeah. Like, stomach turning accounts.
Well, and I also think that one of the things that really, you know, if we're talking about Kara Kaiser's case specifically, and I'm going to call it a case, is the location of the incident that really sparked all of this off. They were on tour. You know, the New York Philharmonic was in Colorado when this happened. And so not only is she having to sort of go through the motions of working with her employer, she's also having to work with law enforcement officers in a completely different state that she's not usually in. You know, had this incident happened in the state, in the jurisdiction, in the city of New York, my legal ears think maybe it wouldn't have. I don't want to speculate, but I can't help but think that being literally and physically removed from the state of Colorado while trying to pursue justice in this only further complicated the situation.
Yeah, and it's like kind of a dog bites man story of like law enforcement fumbles a sexual misconduct and assault.
Film
allegation.
At 11, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that story is as old as time, and it's infuriating every time it happens. The fact that the real evidence that was brought and found in the initial investigation from the New York Phil to be sufficient to dismiss these two players, and then to have that reversed on appeal to the union, like, it's just unconscionable.
Yeah. I mean, I think ultimately what we're all trying to say here is that dear God, this keeps happening. And I also need to hashtag not all men this right now, because this is not that all men are bad. This is that some men are super bad. And hey, it'd be cool if you just didn't do that. And ultimately, it also comes down again, as we've seen in so many of these positions, you know, in circumstances, whether it was a conductor, whether it was Placido, whatever, is that it's about power. You know, there are so many people that are vying for this handful of coveted positions. And when you get it, you are willing to do anything to keep it, including, you know, given to the good old boy culture, remain quiet. And if you don't, you get punished. And that's part of, again, why we are here for the 837,000th time. So men out there, do me a favor and just don't be like these two guys. Like, if you can do that, you're already like setting yourself up for success. So just don't do that.
It's a low bar, but, you know, here at Opera Box Score, we're kind of a low bar kind of podcast. let's lighten the mood just a little bit here. Who's excited to go with me to Barcelona to ride the Caballet train?
Choo-choo!
Heck yeah. I was Google translating the phrase all aboard. Todos a bordo. So we're just going to scream todos a bordo and also scream Montserrat arias as we ride the train.
Next stop, good call, bad call.
Good call, bad call, on Opera Box Score.
Well, the train is pulling in the station, which means it's about time to go home. But first, we have a couple of good calls and or bad calls. I'll go ahead and steal Oliver's that he dropped here. From Oliver, he says, congrats to friend of the show, Emily Polgareltz, for her Met debut and HD broadcast debut as Lisette in La Rondinée. She lit up the stage in every scene she was in and touched the heart in her sweet, sweet duet with Bergsad Davronov as Prunier.
Oliver said he wept more in the show than all the combined performances of Tosca he's attended in his life. And taking into account how old he is, that's quite a lot of Tosca. And for once, a non-controversial take from Oliver. I love it. I think Emily did a fantastic job. Matt Cummings.
Speaking of people who did a fantastic job, everyone should go out there and watch the clip of friend of my heart and friend of the show, Lisa Davidson, performing at NPR's Tiny Desk concert. I mean, like, can you imagine just being in a room at the Tiny Desk? It would seem even tinier with her behind it and making noise on it. But she and pianist Brian Waghorn performed the Ave Maria from Otello, Verdi's Otello, the Greek song Zur Rosenzeit, and closed with Heia in den Bergen from Emmerich Kallmann's Die Tardaschfürsten, and really just like blew the roof off of the studio. Like, it's so good. What can't this woman sing?
Ashley Hardgrave.
Well, I hate to continue the bummer train, but I'm going to do a little bit of that. I always bring you some sort of non-opera recommendation, and I'm doing that again in the form of The Program, which is a three-part docuseries on Netflix. Kathleen Kuber is this incredible filmmaker who is a former student at one of these boarding schools for troubled teens, and she had a really horrific experience there. And so she spends this docuseries, now that she's an adult, going back to the site of the school and interviewing classmates and interviewing people that work for the school, and uncovers what's basically a global scandal in terms of, guess what, following the money and finding where all these people are. It will give you a whole new insight on the scared straight troubled teen discipline of the 1980s and the 1990s. So I encourage you, if you're looking for a new documentary, check out The Program on Netflix. It's excellent.
Well, the bummer train is pulling in at the station. That is it for this week's edition of America's Talk Radio Show about Opera. Make sure you subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. Get your voice heard and find links we've talked about at our website, operaboxscore.com. That's also where you can put your money where our mouths are. Give back to the OBS using the Support the Team tab. Your announcer is Norm Waddell. Your creative consultant is Oliver Camacho. And your audio editor is me. For co-hosts Matt Cummings and Ashley Hardgrave, with guest John Mark Rosendahl, I'm Weston Williams, asking you to continue the conversation about opera and climate activism, especially within earshot of Oliver Camacho. We're back with an all-new show next week, plus you get more opera headlines, more hot takes, and hopefully fewer bummers. Join us.